Will Bitcoin eradicate poverty? My name is Chad Hall, and I've spent most of my life circling paragraphs, poking holes in stories, and taking apart things that I can't always put back together. Whether it's in books or true crime documentaries, conversations or trending topics, I find gaps that most people breeze past. So this is a place to take my questions and to try to understand them. Sometimes I can, sometimes I can't. Sometimes I miss something or I change my mind. This is my podcast. It matters, but it doesn't. It's been a while since I recorded an episode. It's been a while because I had to wrap my head around a few things, and some of those things that I needed to wrap my head around are in this episode. There are some things that I needed a better understanding about in order to feel that I could competently record this episode. So hopefully by the end of this, you'll have an idea of what the relation between Bitcoin and poverty are, but you also have maybe a better understanding of what Bitcoin is. Maybe. A lot of people have tried to explain Bitcoin. Nobody that I ran across before successfully put it into a nice, neat little package. The nice little neat package that I'm going to try to put it in for you today. So wish me luck. Our starting point for this is a quote from Whiplash, How to Survive Our Faster Future by Joey Ito and Jeff Howe. The quote is, to begin with, Bitcoin, unlike so many other technological innovations, deserves the hype. It could lift billions out of poverty, turn our modern banking system into a quaint relic, and generally perform no less magical feat than creating money that functions without, well, money. It's a pretty big statement there. And it's been rolling around in my head. It's been rolling around in my head mostly because when I read the book and I took that highlight, it seemed like a really good statement. But then as I'm reading through it, I started to ask myself, that's really cool, but how? How does it set to disrupt the banking system? How is Bitcoin going to take billions of people out of poverty? And that was not an easy question to answer, because the answer to that is kind of threaded throughout the whole book without being the point of the book. So essentially, I had to reread the book with one question in mind. And as I go through this explanation, there will be points where I'm probably going to be quoting directly from the book. I'm not going to point out every time that I'm quoting, if I'm going to be quoting that often. Just assume that if it sounds smarter than me, it's probably from these two gentlemen who are much, much smarter than I am. So let's do this. Let's tackle this. What is Bitcoin? Bitcoin, I think I got this from Wikipedia. Bitcoin is a decentralized digital currency without a central bank or a single administrator that can be sent from user to user on a peer-to-peer Bitcoin network without the need for intermediaries. Wow, that's a big sentence. Let's try to break that down a little bit more. Decentralized. Actually, let's start with digital currency, okay? It's money. Decentralized means it's not coming from one place. It's not being issued by the United States government, for example. United States government, or the Fed, actually not even the United States government, the federal bank issues currency. That's where the money comes from. One place. Centralized. This is decentralized. It comes from many places. Many places. Let's tackle a little bit more of this definition. Without a central bank or a single administrator. Okay? So the bank or the administrator, the Fed, like I mentioned, is not the center of this. That's all it's saying. And this Bitcoin, this digital currency, can be sent from user to user, so from person to person, using a peer-to-peer network. the Bitcoin network. Peer-to-peer network just means from person to person. There's nobody in between people communicating to each other. And that's exactly what the last part of this says, without the need for intermediaries. Okay? That's what they're saying right there. The key point of this is peer-to-peer. This is money that is created and transacted between people only, from person to person with no one in the middle. No one creating the money, no one controlling the money, no one verifying the money, nobody hoarding the money. That's the point of the whole thing. And this all operates on something called the blockchain. You've probably heard the term blockchain. It's a big, big concept that's been around a lot. It's being used in ways beyond currency. But essentially what a blockchain is, it's a public ledger. A ledger being a place where in the old days you would write things down. If you were a banker, every transaction, you know, Joe Smith came in and took $50. Susie Jenkins deposited $150. Jose Menendez deposited $350. That's a ledger, keeping track of the transactions. Blockchain keeps track of the transactions, every transaction that happens with Bitcoin, all of them. And that is how it prevents, one of the things it prevents is double usage. So for example, double usage would be like if I had a dollar bill and I was able to use that dollar bill to buy more than one thing, that's double usage. You don't want that happening, right? Because it means your money is worthless. So by keeping this ledger, you make sure that when somebody transacts Bitcoin, whether it is they buy something with it or they sell it to someone else, that there is a record in the ledger of that. And the extraordinary thing about the blockchain is that it's not centralized, going back to that definition. And what that means is there's not one person or one group of people maintaining the ledger, maintaining what money is moving and where it's moving. Everybody is tracking it. Everybody is. And in order for things to happen, everybody's ledgers have to match. There's a lot of complexity in that, beyond that, that I'm not going to go into, that I might not even understand, to be honest. But this is something I did not understand before this. Why is it called cryptocurrency? It's called cryptocurrency because the currency is actually codes. Each Bitcoin is actually just a really, really, really long chain of numbers and digital signatures. I say and digital signatures because I'm not positive if it's all numbers or if there are letters and symbols in there as well. And the work of creating a new coin, it involves recording every transaction that's happened in the blockchain into the new coin. Okay, let's break that down a little bit. Maybe that's not super clear. Let's imagine this as a piece of paper, right? As a paper bill, like a dollar bill. A Bitcoin would be like when you took that dollar bill, instead of, you know, the picture of George Washington and the United States of America and all the things that are printed on it, instead printed on it were a bunch of numbers and symbols. And those numbers and symbols were the ledger itself, were the record of every transaction that have ever happened until the moment that this Bitcoin was created. So think about that. There's a few things that that means. First of all, this is creating new Bitcoins is called mining, okay? Terminology we're going to use. Now think about that number. When Bitcoin was new, that means that the number was short. But as more and more people traded Bitcoin, bought things with Bitcoin, the number got longer and longer. In fact, the number is so long and the code is so long that the actual value of Bitcoin is based off of the power it takes for a computer to generate the code. When in October 2009, this website called New Liberty Standard popped up, and this was the first website offering to exchange Bitcoin. In other words, this was the first time that somebody was saying you can trade your Bitcoin for money, for, in this case, I think it was American dollars, but maybe it was a worldwide website, but for accepted, I'm using air quotes here, accepted currencies. And how they judged, they had to create an exchange rate, right? Like, how do you know how many Bitcoins are worth how many dollars? They determined that $1 was equal to 1,309.03 Bitcoins. And how they came across that number, or how they came to that number, was it was based on the cost of electricity that the computer needed to mine Bitcoin at that time. So the amount of electricity that your computer was going to use to generate this number determined at that time in 2009 the price of one Bitcoin. And I don't know if I'm even doing justice to explain how long these numbers are. When it first started, you could do Bitcoin mining with a reasonable computer. Now you need like supercomputers. Like they have these banks of many, meaning like hundreds and hundreds of computers to compute the number to create one Bitcoin. This is actually part of the system. This is how it's supposed to be. It's supposed to get harder and harder to make Bitcoin. And the reason for that is because Satoshi Nakamoto, who is this mysterious person, nobody knows who this is. They don't even know if that is his real name. They don't even know if he's a he. But Satoshi is the creator of Bitcoin. And he, I'm going to use he here because everybody refers to him as a he. Once again, we have no idea. It could be multiple people. We have no idea. But he built scarcity into the system. He built scarcity in the system because when he looked at money currencies throughout the world that had been successful, he saw that it had to do with money. You know, why was gold chosen as something to be valuable? Because there wasn't a ton of it. Why did diamonds become valuable? Because De Beers put a clamp on how many diamonds could leave Africa. They created scarcity. So he realized that he had to create scarcity. So by making the numbers get longer over time and make it harder and harder to create Bitcoin, that maintains some of the value. Because if you could just, you know, keep mining 60 or 70 of them an hour or whatever, it would be worth nothing. You know, it's like toilet paper. And that's what's happened to world currencies before, is that the governments just start printing money and it's not really backed by anything. They're just printing money. It happened to Mexico with pesos. It happened to Italy before the EU. The Italian lira was, I mean, I think it was, I don't even remember what it was. I think it was like something like 10,000 lira was equal to a dollar. I mean, it's like nothing. That's what happens if there's not scarcity, if there's not something backing the money. So he wanted to build that in. That's what stops people from mining stuff and getting rich from mining. That's why you have to buy Bitcoin, right? Because if you could make your own, you know, it's just like dollars. If you could print your own dollars, the dollars would be worthless. But because you have to acquire dollars, because there's only so many in circulation, they maintain a certain value. So there's something else we have to understand here. We understand Bitcoin, hopefully, a little better than we did before. I don't know if I encapsulated that well enough for you to feel like you understand it, but hopefully you understand it enough to understand the rest of this episode. So we're going to talk about now the three different types of currency that there are. First, you have commodity. This is all really basic stuff. There's intricacies to all of this. I'm giving you the basics. But commodity currency is something that has intrinsic value. That means it's worth something on its own. For example, I mentioned earlier, gold. Back when you had gold coins, you're paying somebody with gold. The coin itself is valuable because it's made of gold. So, you know, if you don't want to use it as a coin, you could always melt it down and make a ring or make a necklace. it has intrinsic value. A lot of island cultures use shells as currency because the shells had value. One that was a big one that a lot of us maybe don't understand when we read history, but salt. Salt was a huge commodity currency. In fact, the word salary comes from the word salt, because a salary was an allotted amount of salt that you received for services rendered or whatever, you know, goods rendered. In fact, actually, it's a little bit debated, but it's possible that even the word soldier comes from the word salt. Soldier being someone who received a salary of salt. There's some debate on that one, but salary is for sure from salt. So that's one type of currency. Another type of currency we have is called, and I mean we as in the world or the history of the world, we have representative currency. Representative currency is something that's not worth anything itself, but it is backed up by a commodity. So for example, I have right here, I have a dollar bill, which if I read it correctly, was minted in 1935. Now, what's different about this dollar bill, what my dollar bill that I have here says that is different than the one that you probably have in your wallet right now, is it has the word at the top, silver certificate. Underneath that, it says, this certifies that there is on deposit in the Treasury of the United States. This is a silver certificate dollar. This is representative currency. In fact, it says on the bottom, right under Mr. Washington, $1 in silver payable to the bearer on demand. What that means is even today, I can take this dollar and turn it in and say, give me the silver, and they will give me the silver. Because the silver, according to this $1 bill, is mine. That is representative currency. And as you can see, 1935 and sometime after that, the United States ran on representative currency. We gave out dollar bills, but dollar bills, they were like checks, right? I'm giving you this piece of paper, but this piece of paper says that you own this thing. Gold, in this case, silver. And that continued until 1971, when Richard Nixon took the United States off of the gold standard. You might have heard somebody say that before. What that means is he said that these dollar bills that we were exchanging were no longer backed by gold. In other words, you couldn't take the dollar bill after 1971 and say, give me the gold. It was no longer a representative currency. That it wasn't a one-to-one ratio between what was on the bill and what was being held as gold in Fort Knox. What we moved to is the third kind of currency, a fiat currency. Fiat currency is something that has no intrinsic value and it doesn't have commodity behind it. In other words, the American dollar right now is worth what it's worth because the Fed and the United States government say that's what it's worth. There's nothing actually backing it up. Now, this is a lot of debate. Conservatives and libertarians and liberals all go back and forth on the meaning of this and money. It's one of the big arguments of economics between the left and the right. A lot of people on the right want to go back to the gold standard, which I can kind of understand. Like the idea of like this being worth silver is kind of cool. But there's obviously problems with that. We're not going to get into the problems with that being if you go back to that, you have less money on the market. So a lot of people that are poorer become more poor because there's no money for them. Like I said, a lot of intricacies to that, like Bitcoin as well and the blockchain. This is just surface understanding so that you can understand the rest of the episode. The reason I bring up these three types of currencies is because it's a debate on Bitcoin, whether Bitcoin is a fiat currency. It has no intrinsic value, right? Because it's just numbers. You know, you can't trade those numbers for a cheeseburger. And it's not backed up by anything, right? Because it's decentralized. It's not coming from a bank. So it's not being issued. So it's not backed up by anything. But there's an argument that says that the definition of fiat doesn't mean what I just said, that what fiat means is legal tender backed by a central government. So they tie it directly to government or a banking institution as defining a fiat. Whereas if you go to Wikipedia and you look up the definition of fiat, they're a little more flexible. You know, it says that it has value only because a government maintains its value or because parties engaging in exchange agree on its value. So in that definition, Bitcoin would be a fiat. Whereas in the other one, it wouldn't be because it's not coming from the government or a bank. Which one's right? I don't know. Satoshi said in an essay talking about Bitcoin back in the early days, the root problem with conventional currency is all the trust that's required to make it work. The central bank must be trusted not to debase the currency. But the history of fiat currencies is full of breaches of that trust. Banks must be trusted to hold our money and transfer it electronically. But they lend it out in waves of credit bubbles with barely a fraction in reserve. So it kind of sounds like he's saying in there that he doesn't think that he's created a fiat. You could read that either way. So one more thing before we get back to the question of how Bitcoin relates to poverty. That other thing is one of the key arguments of Whiplash, this book that I've pulled the quote from. Push and pull. The difference between push and pull. Push is allocating resources. You push something somewhere, you set it aside, you stockpile it, you put grain in a silo, you put gold in Fort Knox, you allocate resources. You say this many soldiers here, this many soldiers here, you allocate resources, you push them out. In a way, this relates back to centralization, right? It's pushing from the center. You're pushing things where you think they need to be. On the other hand, you have pull. Pull is based around the idea of need, taking or pulling resources. So instead of things sitting and waiting where we think they need to be, they are pulled and moved between needs. So in a way, they never stop moving. And it's about using what's needed only at the precise moment that it's needed as well. Timing is a big thing in pull. In a way, you could also look at this as top-down versus bottom-up. The top, if we're looking at a pyramid, is dictating down where things go. Whereas bottom-up is the people at the bottom saying, we need this, we need this, we need this, we need this, and resources moving down, flowing down to them. A good example of this in, I guess, technology would be the word you could use here, is the difference between Encarta, which was a encyclopedia, digital encyclopedia that Microsoft made, and Wikipedia. As you know, Wikipedia, highly successful. Encarta, not so much. And Encarta had tons of research. It was highly produced. It was a quality product in every way. But the problem with Encarta was Encarta didn't understand the web. And Encarta was push. It was dictating the information that people needed to know, that it decided what people need to know. You need to know about this bug, skip that bug. Whereas Wikipedia is bottom up. It's made by the people. So as somebody needs a Wikipedia page about a thing, it is created. Need dictates what exists on Wikipedia. This description here is not really doing the job anymore. We need a better one. Hence, you get another one. The main thing about pull versus push is it's about agility. It's about moving things fast to where they need to be. This is actually a quote from the book. We should try to use resources that can be utilized just in time for just the time necessary, then relinquished. Now, let's go back to what I said about a grain in a silo. Why would this thing about things being there just when they're needed and then moving, why would that be important? Well, think about putting grain in a silo. It's food, right? So you're assuming the people that are around this silo are going to need this food. But if they don't need it for long enough, it rots. And then it's gone. Whereas if grain was continually moving from hungry person to hungry person, and you just continue to produce grain and it continues to move to where the need is, it never has time to rot. Nothing is wasted. Better use of resources. That's kind of the main argument of push versus pull. Another great example of this is Amazon's web service, Amazon A3. They do kind of like what I just said with the grain. When you put a website or you put anything onto Amazon servers, normally the way things used to work was like renting an apartment, right? Or renting a warehouse. This space is mine. You know, if you go to Amazon and you say, I need 10 gigs for my website, they look at their server. If they were doing it the old way, they would carve out 10 gigs and say, this belongs to you. Nobody else will be using this 10 gigs. If you only use one of it, the other 9 will sit there unused, just like that grain. Amazon does not do that. What Amazon does, what A3 does, is it observes your usage. Now, obviously, this has to do with not storing files, but this has to do with people coming onto your website and the traffic, right? Because that's changing moment to moment. Obviously, if you have something saved, that stays yours. We're talking about the need for the traffic, for the bandwidth, and for all of those other things that are required, but change depending on how many people are visiting a website. So what A3 does is it watches that. And you're only using this little square. Say, you know, you're using this square on a server in California, and you're only using a gig. That's how much memory you need to keep all of the files that you have for your website, so that when somebody clicks on it, they see the things that you have written there and the pictures that you have. That only requires 1 gig, and it's saved, right? So that's sitting on a server in California and reiterated all the places it needs to be reiterated for backup. But all of a sudden you get a spike, you know, like maybe you get on television, all of a sudden you're getting more traffic to your website and then the usage spikes up. Well, instead of having that other 9 gigs set aside for you, Amazon waits until the moment that it sees you need it and grabs it from wherever it's available. So it could be like grab a gig here from Texas, grab a gig here from India, grab a gig here from Canada, and it allows you to use them until you no longer use it anymore. And then it's freed back up for resources for anybody else. So that's an idea of pull. The need is pulling the resources. The resources aren't set aside. Another example of this is after the 3.11 earthquake in Japan, in March of 2011, hence the name 3.11, that huge earthquake that caused all of those tsunamis and all of that, and it caused, remember the reactor, the Fukushima reactor? After that happened, because of the Fukushima reactor, right, everybody was pulled out of, obviously you want to pull everybody out of harm's way. One of the things that they needed, people in Japan needed, is they needed Geiger counters, which are devices to measure radioactivity. They needed Geiger counters to go out and measure the radioactivity of places so that they could figure out what was safe, what places weren't safe, whether the radioactivity was moving in clouds, all the things you would expect to need to know about radioactivity after a nuclear reactor leaks. So in push, which is, you know, the getting resources from the government, the way that it happened was push. Here you go. Here are the Geiger counters we have. And here's this, you know, here's the food and here's all the things you need. But the Geiger counters weren't enough. There weren't enough of them. And they weren't specifically, I don't want to say calibrated. They weren't specifically built to measure what they needed to measure in the way that they needed to measure it. So push was failing. So what happened was a group got together and they created this thing called Safecast, which is the name of a community of volunteers. And they crowdfunded money to, at first, get more Geiger counters, but then they realized that the Geiger counters were unfortunately becoming harder to get to since people in California buying Geiger counters because, you know, technically we are in the path of that radiation. So the Geiger counters weren't available. So what these Safecast people realized is they needed a crowdfund in order to build their own Geiger counters. And the great thing about building their own Geiger counters is they could build ones specifically for the need and the uses of that specific incident. That's another thing about push. Push relies on generalizations. Here's a Geiger counter. What's this Geiger counter meant to do? Well, it's versatile. It'll work in a lot of situations. It's not going to work specifically the best in every situation, but it's made more for variety. But what they needed was something specifically made just for this one case. So they built their own. This is also from the book. I said I wasn't going to tell you what I was reading from the book, but I did a good job of marking when they came from the book, I think. The Safecast project showed that a dedicated group of volunteers guided by the ethos of the open software and hardware movements could build tools that were more accurate and more useful in a rapidly changing environment than the official tools provided by the government. And the reason that we are talking about all this push and pull and all of this stuff is because currency, as we understand it, centralized currency, is push. Not just in the sense of how money is rolled out, you know, new currency is rolled out, but also where it exists. It sits in this bank. It sits here with these people. It's all centralized in the core. And that's part of the reason, the argument they're making here is that's part of the reason that we have poverty, is because the money isn't moving where the need is. The money is stockpiling. But Bitcoin seeks to remove the authority. It seeks to remove that centralization. It democratizes the currency. And it moves from push into pull. So it pulls the money where it's needed instead of being hoarded. That is the crux of the argument, that it breaks away from the idea of a bank issuing things and the deciding how much money needs to be produced and all of these things that are dictated from one central place. And instead, let me read a few more of these quotes. I'm going to use these last three quotes. They sound like they're all one because they fit together so well, but these are three separate quotes. And I think it's going to explain it better than me trying to break this down. The world is changing. And instead of stocking resources and information, controlling everything, planning everything, and pushing messages and orders from the core to the edge, innovation is now happening at the edges. This is the power of pull over push. It leverages modern communication technologies and the decreased cost of innovation to move power from the core to the edges, enabling serendipitous discoveries and providing opportunities for innovators to mine their own passions. As the cost of innovation continues to fall, entire communities that have been sidelined by those in power will be able to organize themselves and become active participants in society and government. So the main thing I want you to focus in on there is from the core to the edges. That's another way of saying decentralization. So rather than the decisions being made at the center, they're made around the edges. That the need dictates the choices rather than the policies and the decisions. That's the whole idea. This is why so many people are excited about Bitcoin, because it has the potential to change the world. But one thing that you shouldn't forget, I don't want to leave you with 100% roses on this. One thing you shouldn't forget is, number one, we don't know if it'll work. And number two, it might be a fiat. Even if it isn't technically a fiat, it is a fiat, right? The money, the currency, has nothing backing it up. It means what it means because we say that's what it means. And that is an edgy proposition, because you don't know what that's going to mean in the long run. So that's Bitcoin and the possibilities of Bitcoin. It was a tough one to wrap my head around. Hopefully I did a decent job. And as far as connecting to episodes in the archive, I've never really talked about currency or economics before. So I don't really have an episode to directly connect it to. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to recommend an episode that I love. There's an episode back from 2017 called The Confrontation of Fear. This is one of the first solo episodes I did. And I was really trying to do a lot of sound design and stuff like that. I made all kinds of music for the episode. I think it came out pretty cool. So go check that one out. Thanks for listening. And I hope I injected a little bit of juice into that extraordinary brain of yours. Be sure to subscribe to the show, share episodes, and go to itmattersbutitdoesn't.com, where you can subscribe to my newsletter. I mean, if you like the podcast, you're going to love that. Every day I send out highlights exactly like the one in this episode. Each of them is a nugget, a note, a quote, or an idea for you to ponder. And the emails are short and easy to read in a quick minute, like a tweet. And I also like to send out book recommendations once a week. And after you sign up for that and you're still on my website, you can click support for a list of ways to support the show, including joining my Patreon. So go do it now. Go check out itmattersbutitdoesn't.com for all of that. The full episode archive going back to 2016, a link to my public notebook, and some other stuff. All right, I'll see you when I see you.